Thank you all for being here and for the opportunity to talk to you today. This is a conference that's about innovation in the payment system. I know that all the businesses that are represented here will have their own particular approaches to innovation, and a lot of that is going to be on display in the various presentations at this event. But we also have a common interest in ensuring that the system as a whole develops as efficiently and cost-effectively as possible. I've been asked to talk to you today about the Reserve Bank's role in that. As you know, the RBA launched a strategic review of payments innovation in July last year. In talking about the review, the first thing that I want to stress is that we see this very much as a cooperative project. When we announced the review, the first thing that we did was to call for an initial round of consultations, both with industry and with other interested parties who wanted to contribute. We've had a good response to that. We've had discussions, sometimes multiple discussions, with most of the main market players. We've been talking to people working in particular fields of payments innovation, and we've had some discussions with end users of the payment system. Based on what we learn from that, we'll be putting together a more detailed paper for release around mid-year, and then we'll be having a second and more formal round of consultation in the second half of the year. And we hope to have a final report ready by around year-end. I've started with that description of how the process is working because I wanted to emphasise that this is very much something that we're doing in cooperation with the interested parties. And it's not just a top-down exercise. The process still has some way to go, and I'm not going to preempt any of the findings in my talk today. But what I want to do is to use the time available to report on progress to date, how we're approaching the task, and to give you a preliminary sense of the issues that we're focusing on from here. The first question that you might ask is, why do we need a strategic review in this area and why now? I have to say that there's no particular trigger for having it now, but we do believe that it's a good general principle that these things should be kept under periodic review. The Reserve Bank, through its Payment System Board, has a mandate to promote payment system efficiency. A good deal of the work that we've done in that area has focused on the efficiency of price signals. And you'd be familiar with that. The bank has taken the view that where price signals are distorted for some reason, then there's a case for us to step in and use regulatory powers to correct that. But efficiency also covers operational aspects of the system, including things like the cost, the speed, and the reliability of payment services, and what's the subject of today's talk, the capacity of the system to innovate. When we think about innovation in a network setting like this one, it's useful to distinguish between two different types. Proprietary innovations, where the benefits are localised to the business that's doing the innovating and to their customers, and system-wide innovations, where the benefit accrues to the system as a whole. It's reasonable to expect that industry will do a good job with the first of those types of innovation, and in fact, we see examples of that happening all the time. For example, we're currently seeing financial institutions exploring new ways of using mobile devices to make payments, and similarly, we're seeing at least one major bank promoting real-time information systems for updating customer accounts. So those are examples of proprietary innovation, but it's the second type of innovation, the system-wide innovation, where we see the most serious potential for inefficiency or for underinvestment. That might happen through a lack of coordination amongst industry participants or through a lack of incentive for individual participants to participate in system-wide improvements. We're not starting with the presumption that that's the case, only that it could be. As a regulator, we recognise that our approach to these questions has to be quite different from some of the other cases that we have for regulatory involvement. The RBA has significant powers, as you know, to designate payment systems and to set standards. But we're well aware that you can't regulate innovation into being. That's not the intention of this review. As far as possible, we'll be aiming to work with industry, looking at whether there are areas where coordination is needed and assisting with that where we usefully can. In taking on a project like this, it's useful to start off with some idea of the characteristics that we're looking to promote in an efficient payment system. So let me give you a few of the main ones. First of all, timeliness. Not all payments are time critical, but users of the system should at least have options available to them to give recipients timely access to their funds and to give both parties timely confirmation of a payment. Another one is accessibility. It's desirable that everyone who needs to make and receive payments should have access to the system. Ease of use. It goes without saying that systems that are easier to use are more preferable than systems that are cumbersome to use. But it's not only an issue of convenience. Systems that require manual entry of account and transaction details are prone to errors that can be costly to correct and that can discourage use. That's one reason why payment cards are so popular, because most of the need for manual entry is removed. The need to know a recipient's account details is another challenge for many payment methods. One of our oldest payment methods, the cheque, deals with that by only requiring the recipient's name, leaving the recipient to handle the rest. The challenge for the electronic payment system is to replicate or improve upon that sort of convenience. Another desirable characteristic is ease of integration with other processes. Payments are rarely made in complete isolation. Typically, they're made as part of a process that requires reconciliation and recording of information by at least one of the parties involved. It's desirable that payment systems should be able to integrate efficiently with those sorts of processes. The key example is the capacity of the payment system to carry additional reconciliation information with the payment. Another desirable quality is safety and reliability. End users of a payment system need to have confidence that the system will be available when they need it and that payments will reach the intended recipient at the time promised. They also need to be confident that the system is secure, so that using it won't expose them to risk of fraud, for example, if their details were to become fraudulently obtained by another party. Some of those problems can be addressed by system participants agreeing to guarantee payments, but the more fundamental solution is good system design. And finally, low and transparent costs. Some would say that this has been a particular preoccupation of the RBA in its regulatory involvement over the past decade. Obviously, if two systems perform exactly the same function, then we should prefer the cheaper one. But the reality, we know, is more complicated than that. Each system typically has different attributes from every other system, and so end users need to be able to make choices as to which system delivers what they want in the most cost-effective way. That means that costs need to be transparent so that those choices can be well informed. So those are some of the qualities that we might regard as desirable in an efficient payment system. You can probably think of a few more. But having given a list like that, the other important point to make is that there are trade-offs in all of these sorts of evaluations. Investment in innovation comes at a cost, borne initially by industry, but ultimately borne by the consumer. And so in conducting this review, it's going to be important for us to be talking with providers and end users of payment services to get an assessment of both the costs and benefits of the different approaches. One important source of information that we'll have about that from the end user perspective will be the Reserve Bank's latest payment use study. This was a study of about 1,200 households conducted in October, November last year, and it updates an earlier study that we conducted in 2007. Participants in the study were asked to keep a diary of their payments over a one-week period, and they were also asked to provide responses showing their attitudes to newer payment methods like contactless or mobile payments. We expect to publish a detailed analysis of the findings later in the year, but today I'm going to give you a few preliminary results from that study that I think throw some useful light on the innovation review. Results from the diary of payments actually made suggest two main sets of conclusions on payments patterns. First of all, the broad pattern of payments behaviour that was observed in our 2007 study still holds. Cash remains the most widely used payment instrument in Australia and the dominant instrument for low-value payments. Cards are the dominant payment method for mid-value payments between $50 and $500, with the use of credit cards growing relative to debit as the value increases within that range. BPAY and internet banking are used frequently for bill payments and for high-value transactions. That's the first set of conclusions. Secondly, payment patterns have nonetheless evolved to some degree in the 3 years since the original study. In particular, the use of cash has been declining. This is especially noticeable in cash's share of what we might call traditional payment methods. Cash is down from 40 to about 30% of the value of those kinds of payments. Debit cards seem to have substituted for cash, with scheme debit and FPOS transactions both gaining share in that category. So those are the broad results that cover the pattern of payments that are actually made. Now, as I said, attached to the diary, we also included a questionnaire which asks people their attitudes to different payment methods and how they think about those. So I'm going to give you just a few examples from that. First of all, on the use of cheques, fewer than 40% of consumers reported making a payment by cheque in the past year. Of those 40%, this graph shows us the main reason why they chose to use a cheque. The most common reason you can see was that people felt that they had no alternative for the type of payment that they were making. I think that's a significant response, given that one of the issues being considered both by the industry and by the RBA review is the scope for phasing out cheque use. Next, in order to understand the attributes that people value for point-of-sale payments, we asked people what factors influence their choice of payment method at the checkout. Perhaps not surprisingly, the most important factor was what they happened to be carrying with them at the time. Beyond that, the main factor cited in determining how people pay was the speed of processing the transaction, followed by the ability to use their own funds and the capacity of that payment method to assist in managing finances. The importance of speed, I think, is significant because it helps explain why people continue to use cash for small value transactions, and also I think it indicates that the current push towards contactless payments might well prove to be quite important for some customers. Given the increasing importance of internet payments over recent years, we also spent some time exploring consumers' use of and attitudes towards different types of online payments. First of all, we found what seems to be quite high adoption of online payments. Around 90% of respondents had access to the internet, either at home or at work, and of those, 80% reported having made an online purchase, and almost 60% reported an online transfer of funds to a family member or friend. A surprisingly high 60% of people with internet access said they pay most of their bills online. We also tried to find out what things prevent people from making greater use of online payments. This graph that I'm showing here shows the answer for online bill payments, but we also collected some responses for online purchases and for online transfer payments. So what did consumers say would improve online bill payments? Well, first of all, to explain the large bar at the bottom, we were asking people what would make them happier to use this form of payment, but what we found was that for more than a quarter of respondents, they were already satisfied and they didn't think that it could be improved. Beyond that, by far the biggest factor deterring people from making greater use of online payments was the risk of fraud. I didn't bring a graph of it for online purchases, but for that category, fraud was an even bigger concern. About half of respondents indicated that the risk of fraud was a discouraging factor for greater use. And in fact, the level of satisfaction reported by consumers was generally less for general online payments and purchases than it was for online bill payments. Now, we also collected some data on attitudes and use of newer types of payment methods, including mobile payments. Adoption of things like mobile payments and also contactless technology is much lower so far than for online payments. Only around 3% of survey respondents had made a contactless payment in the last month, and less than 10% of respondents had ever made mobile payments. Where they had, the main purpose was for phone-related purchases, like purchasing ringtones or games. Most of the other mobile payments reported were effectively internet payments made using a smartphone. So in short, the survey doesn't seem to point to any major dissatisfaction amongst consumers with payment services in Australia, but it does shed some light on why payment use patterns are as they are, and it indicates some possible areas for improvement that can be looked at further. And we'll be publishing a fuller analysis of those results later in the year. As I said earlier, we've had a significant interest shown by a wide range of industry and other players in response to our initial request for comments on the discussion paper for the study. A number of interested parties have provided us with written submissions, and many more have made themselves available for informal discussions with RBA staff. I expect we'll also receive a more substantial body of submissions to the review during the second half of the year after we release our detailed consultation paper. The consultations that we've had to date have highlighted a number of quite specific issues that are going to be worth considering as part of our review. And I'd like to briefly just go through a cross-section of these, but what I'm going to present today is by no means exhaustive. I note in preface to that, that many of the issues that I'm going to raise here are not new, and they're already being thought about by the industry. First of all, transmission of data with payments. Successful integration of payment systems into other processes requires that sufficient information travel with a payment to allow proper reconciliation. A business owner making a payment to a supplier might wish to supply information not just on the invoice number, but possibly on the particular item of the invoice that's being paid and why. An employer making a payment to a super fund similarly might need to be able to provide information on relevant employee accounts and the amounts of each payment and the type of payment involved. Even an individual sending money on a private transfer to a relative or friend might want to attach a personal message to that payment. Now, at the moment, for these kinds of requirements, the choices are largely either to limit the amount of information to the 18 characters permitted by the direct entry system, to separate the payment from the information with the intention of bringing those two the bits of information back together again at a later stage, or to pay by cheque attached to the information source. The question for the strategic review will be whether this is likely to represent a significant shortcoming in our payment system in the years ahead, and if it is, what's the best means of addressing it, and how should we go about achieving that? The second thing that we're looking at is timeliness and ease of addressing payments. There are times when the person making a payment really wants that payment to be made quickly. A classic example of that is government emergency payments for things like disaster relief. Most government payments to individuals can be made perfectly adequately by the direct entry system. But in an emergency, the availability of funds the next day might not be sufficient. In recent times, many such payments have been made using the RTGS system, even though this is actually a long way away from the intended use of that system. Even then, speed can vary significantly depending upon the systems in the recipient bank. A related issue is the ease of addressing payments to individuals. As I said before, writing somebody's name on a cheque is relatively straightforward, but directing an electronic payment can be much more difficult. For most people, this currently involves entering a BSB and an account number into an internet banking package. This, of course, means having to obtain that information from the recipient, who mightn't even remember the information, and then keying in all the details correctly. So probably this kind of process doesn't meet the ease of use test. Overseas experience might be a guide to us on this issue. For example, we know that the United States is putting a lot of emphasis on prepaid cards for government payments, although probably this reflects that country's high number of unbanked welfare recipients. On the other side of the Atlantic, the UK's faster payment system is a closely watched example also of efforts to improve the timeliness of payments. Obviously, the strategic review needs to be forward-looking, and so we should be asking not just how much demand there is for these kinds of services, but also the extent to which likely developments could meet that demand over the next few years. These questions, I think, might also lead to a focus on the constraints in banking systems' own internal systems and the limits that that might place on their own capacity to provide faster payments. Another issue, it's already been mentioned earlier today, is the decline of cheques. The number of cheques written in Australia has been declining by an average rate of about 9% per annum over the last decade. Over time, that's adding to unit costs for cheque use. The result is that cheques, which were already an expensive form of payment, are becoming even more so. Nonetheless, our consultations with users of the payment system have reinforced the fact that cheque use remains entrenched in certain areas because it meets a number of specific needs. I've already mentioned a number of these areas, including the ease with which cheques can be addressed to others and accompanied by additional information. They're also very suitable for face-to-face exchanges and, in some instances, as a device for providing an element of financial control on payments being made, for example, by small businesses. Any decision to move away from cheques, and I'm not prejudging the issue, will be dependent on the industry's capacity to develop suitable and equally convenient electronic alternatives. I'm aware that the industry is separately looking at this, but it seems appropriate that the Payment System Board should also be considering how the decline in cheques is addressed from a public interest perspective. In addition to those issues that I've just mentioned, there are a number of other things that we expect will come into consideration, whether as standalone topics or in connection with other things that are on the agenda. Those include mobile payments, There's already a lot of focus on that. The board's main interest in that area will be in determining whether there are any impediments to the development of mobile payments, for example, in relation to standards. Standards themselves are another area that potentially needs to be looked at. The increasingly global nature of commerce suggests that adoption of internationally compatible standards will be very important for maintaining a world-class payment system. Electronic purse systems, that is general purpose prepaid and typically contactless cards like Oyster in London and Octopus in Hong Kong. Where these have been successful, it's mainly been in conjunction with transport ticketing systems, and those have been slow to develop here. The question once again is whether there are significant impediments to the development of those systems in Australia, given the already high use of payment cards. And security. Our survey suggests that concerns about fraud are impeding the take-up of online payments. And this has also been an issue for mobile payments. The question for the strategic review is whether there's a need for increased coordination and cooperation on fraud issues. The final point that I'd like to make is that more important than any of the individual issues that I've listed here is the overarching environment for innovation. I made the distinction at the start between proprietary innovation and system-wide innovation. Our focus in this review has been, and will be, very much on the second one of those. This is the area that needs most careful attention from a public interest perspective, because it requires a degree of cooperation amongst industry competitors, which might not otherwise happen efficiently. It also requires that the interests of end users and non-incumbents be taken into account. The next stage of the review will be seeking views on those issues, whether there are better ways to address them, and whether there are new areas where a cooperative approach is needed. An inevitable component of that is what role the Reserve Bank itself should play, given that it has often stepped in one way or another, when a solely industry-based approach hasn't proved feasible. So to conclude, what I've outlined today is a big agenda, and I expect it will keep us very busy in the time ahead. As I said at the start, this review is very much a cooperative effort. I and my staff appreciate the assistance that we've already had from industry participants and from other interested parties, and we look forward to continuing to work with you to promote best practice innovation in the Australian payment system. Thanks very much for listening.
I know that the 2007 report, payments report that you referred to in your opening remarks, added a great degree of richness to the data available to the Australian market. And so I'm sure that most people in this room will be looking forward to the release later this year of the update. Given that the interval is almost 4 years apart, do you believe that that will become an ongoing mechanism for the RBA, or is this seen as simply another one-off report?
It's very hard for me to say at this stage, because I can't commit future funds of the RBA to be spending on another survey. I think it has been a useful source of information for us, and so what I presented today was just a teaser. The information specifically from today will be on our website today, but as I said, there'll be a more detailed set of results with more detailed analysis a bit later in the year. I can't say whether we'll be doing another one in 3 years' time or not, but I appreciate the positive feedback. Thanks.
G'day. Luke Opal from ZDNet Australia. I've got two questions, but they're brief. You said that mobile wallets like the Oyster card and the Octopus card have been slow to develop here in Australia. Why do you think that is?
I think the main reason for that is the one that I mentioned in the talk, which is that these things very closely tied into usability for public transport, and I think that is an area where a degree of standardisation and cooperation is needed. That has been slow to develop here. I can't tell you who I'm blaming for that or anything like that. I just make the observation.
No worries. Second question. You mentioned that a couple of banks are proclaiming the benefit of real-time banking and so on, one in particular. Other banks, are the other banks doing as much? I mean, this is a very detailed consultation process you're going through for the overhaul of RBA innovation payments. Are other banks, are private banks doing enough to overhaul their systems to keep up? Obviously, innovation shared. Is everyone moving forward at the same pace, or are there some that are lagging?
Well, I wouldn't say everybody's moving at exactly the same pace, but I know that all the banks are investing heavily in their systems. And as you know, there have been some well-publicised system deficiencies in recent times as well, and the banks that have been subject to that are also now looking very closely at that and investing in rectifying the problems. The specific question you were raising is the capacity of banks to deliver timely account information to customers. I think that is an innovation that has got quite a bit further to go across the system, because one of the things that we're looking at in this review, and that I think if we're serious about international best practice, we need to be serious about faster payments. Now, faster payments depends partly upon the infrastructure for interbank payments, because payments need to be able to get on a timely basis from bank to bank to make that happen. But that will be of limited benefit to the customer unless individual banks also have the capacity to post transactions in a timely fashion to their customers' accounts.
Malcolm, hi, it's Adam Wan from Visa. In your presentation, you mentioned in the past where price signals were distorted, you'd found a case for the RBA to intervene to rectify that situation. I just wanted to take the opportunity to ask you about surcharging, card surcharging, and whether the RBA thinks the proliferation of excessive and blended surcharging is a distortion of the price signal that you were originally after with permitting surcharging on cards, and is there a case for some action in that area?
Okay, thanks very much. I know this is an area of concern, and we've had a number of people talk to us about this, not just people in the industry, but also we've had feedback from payment system users as well. So I recognise that it's an issue. I think at this stage all I can really do is reiterate the general principle that I enunciated earlier today, which is that we believe that good quality price signals are an important part of the payment system, and so we take that seriously. The particular issue of surcharging is one that we have under continuous review.
Julian Bykowski from the Australian Financial Review. Just on that issue of surcharging, and given what the RBA's position has been over a period of time, there does seem to be some clear evidence that particular merchants are gouging now. And is the RBA prepared to take any sort of remedial action on a one-on-one basis or send some sort of a signal, or do you see that lying with a different regulator?
I think it's a bit misleading to say that the RBA should be taking action on merchants. We don't have any power over merchants. What we do have is regulatory power to designate and set standards for payment systems, and we have set standards for the credit card schemes which prevent them from having a no surcharge rule. So I think when Visa or MasterCard raises this question, what they're really asking for is a modification of the RBA standard in relation to their capacity to set rules on surcharging, but there is no RBA power to regulate the surcharges that merchants charge.